As they rode back to Isakandarabad, Al-Salil and Sagai listened to Verity's account of the near tragedy. When Al-Salil asked Mansur for his version of events, Mansur replied quite naturally in Arabic, and Verity was obliged to go along with the deception that he spoke no English. She translated for her father his praises of her courage and resourcefulness, and could omit none of his hyperbole now that she knew Mansur understood every word. At the end, Sir Guy smiled tightly and nodded to Mansur. "Please tell him that we are in his debt." Then his expression turned bleak. "You were at fault. You should not have been alone in his company, child. Your behaviour was scandalous. It will not happen again." Once again, Mansur saw fear in her eyes. The sun had set, and it was almost dark when they reached the encampment. Verity found her tent lit with lamps whose wicks floated in perfumed oil, and her clothing from the ship had been unpacked. Three handmaidens were waiting to attend her. When she was ready for her bath, they poured warm, perfumed pitchers of water over her, and giggled as they marvelled at the whiteness and beauty of her naked body. The evening meal was laid out under a dazzle of stars, and the desert air had cooled. They sat cross-legged on cushions, while the musicians played softly. After they had eaten, servants offered hookahs to the caliph and Sagai. Only Al-Salil indulged. Sagai lit a long black cheroot from the gold case that Verity carried for him. Politely, she offered one to Mansur. "Thank you, my lady, but I have never found tobacco to my taste." "I agree with you. I also find the odour of the smoke unpleasant in the extreme." Instinctively, she had lowered her voice, even though her father spoke no Arabic. Now Mansur was certain she was terrified of him. There was more to her feelings than simply that Sir Guy was a daunting figure, hard and unyielding, and Mansur knew he would have to be circumspect in what he now had in mind. He kept his voice on the same even level when he spoke again. "At the end of the street there lies an ancient temple to Aphrodite. The moon rises a little before midnight. Although dedicated to a pagan deity, in the moonlight the temple is very lovely." Verity had not heard him, or so it seemed from her lack of reaction. She turned back to translate a remark that Sir Guy had made to Al-Salil, and the two men continued their earnest conversation. They were discussing the extent of the caliph's gratitude to Sir Guy for his intervention with the company and the British government. In what manner could the caliph best demonstrate it? Al-Salil asked. Sir Guy suggested delicately that 5 lakhs of gold rupees might be appropriate, which should be followed by an annual payment of another lakh. The caliph began to understand how his brother had amassed such vast wealth. It would take 2 ox carts to carry that amount of gold. The treasury in Muscat no longer held a tenth of that amount. But he did not inform Sir Guy of this. Instead, he brought the subject to a close. "These are matters we can discuss again, for I hope to enjoy many more days of your company. But now, if we are to rise again before the sun tomorrow, we should repair to our sleeping mats. May pleasant dreams attend your slumbers." Verity took her father's arm as he escorted her to her tent, with torchbearers leading them through the encampment. In turmoil, Mansur watched her go. He had no indication that she would honour their assignation. Later, dressed in a dark cloak, he waited in the temple of Aphrodite. Through a hole in the dilapidated roof, the moonlight played on the full statue of the goddess. The pearly marble glowed as though with internal life. Both her arms were missing, for the ages had taken their toll. But the figure was graceful, and the battered head smiled in eternal ecstasy. Mansur had stationed Istaf, his trusted coxswain, from the Sprite, on the roof to keep guard. Now Istaf whistled softly. Mansur caught his breath, and his pulse beat faster. He stood up from his seat on one of the tumbled stone blocks and moved to the centre of the temple so that she would see him at once and not be startled by his sudden appearance from out of the shadows. He saw the dim light of the lamp she carried as she came down the narrow alley, stepping over the rubble and debris of 3,000 years. At the entrance she paused and looked across at him, then set her lamp in a niche in the doorway and threw back her hood. She had braided her hair in a single rope that hung down over one shoulder, and in the moonlight her face was as pale as that of the goddess. He let his own cloak fall open to hang from his shoulders and went to meet her. He saw that her expression was serious and remote. When he was within arm's length, she put out a hand to stop him coming closer. "If you touch me, I shall have to leave at once," she said. "You heard my father's rebuke. I was never again to be alone with you." "Yes, I heard. I understand your predicament," he assured her. "I am grateful you've come. What happened today was wrong." "I am to blame," he said. "There is no blame on either of us. We had been close to death. Our expressions of relief and gratitude towards each other were only natural in the circumstances. However, I said foolish things. You must forget my words. This is the last time we shall meet like this. I shall fall in with your wishes." "Thank you, Your Highness." Mansur switched to English. "Will you not at least treat me as a friend and call me Mansur, and not by the title that sits so uncomfortably on your lips?" She smiled and answered in the same language. "If that is indeed your true name, it seems to me that you are a great deal more than you seem, Mansur." "I have promised to explain it to you, Verity." "Yes, indeed you have. That is why I have come." Then she added, as though she were trying to convince herself, "And for no other reason." She turned away and took a seat on a fallen stone block just large enough to accommodate her alone, and she gestured to another at a discreet distance. "Will you not be seated and make yourself at ease? It seems to me that your tale will take some telling." He sat facing her. She leaned forward with one elbow on her knee and her chin in the palm of her hand. "You have all of my attention." He laughed and shook his head. "Where to begin? How will I ever make you believe me?" He paused to gather his thoughts. "Let me start with the most preposterous. If I can convince you of those parts of it, then the rest of the medicine will not be so difficult for you to swallow." She inclined her head in invitation, and he drew breath. "Like yours, my English surname is Courtney. I am your cousin." She burst out laughing. "In all fairness, you did warn me. Nonetheless, 'tis bitter medicine that you are trying to dole out to me." She made as if to rise. "I see that this is but a prank, and you take me for the fool. Wait," he entreated. "Give me a fair hearing." She sank back on the stone. "Have you heard the names Thomas and Dorian Courtney?" The smile vanished from her lips, and she nodded wordlessly. "What have you heard?" She thought for a moment, her expression troubled. "Tom Courtney was a terrible rogue. He was my father's twin brother. He murdered his other brother, William, and had to fly from England. He died somewhere in the African wilderness. His grave is unmarked and his passing unmourned." "Is that all you know of him?" "No, there is more," Verity admitted. "He is guilty of something even more heinous." "What is worse than the murder of your own brother?" Verity shook her head. "I know none of the details, only that it was so foul a deed that his name and his memory are blackened for ever. I do not know the full extent of his wickedness, but since we were children we have been forbidden to mention his name." "When you say we, Verity, who is the other person?"
"My older brother, Christopher."
"It pains me to be the one to tell you, but what you have been told about Tom Courtney is but a sad travesty of the truth," Mansur said. "But before we discuss it further, please tell me what you know of Dorian Courtney." Verity shrugged. "Very little, for there is little to know. He was my father's youngest brother." "No, that is not correct. He was my father's half-brother. In a tragic turn of events, he fell into the hands of Arab pirates when he was but a child of 10 or 12 years. Tom Courtney, that craven rogue, was to blame for his abduction, and did nothing to prevent it or to save him. Dorian died of fever, neglect, and a broken heart while he was a captive in the lair of the pirates."
"How do you know all this?"
"My father told us about it, and with my own eyes I have seen Dorian's grave in the old cemetery on Lamu Island. I placed flowers upon it and said a prayer for his poor little soul. I take comfort in the words of Christ, 'Suffer, little children, to come to me.' I know he rests in the bosom of Jesus." In the moonlight, Mansur saw a tear tremble on her bottom eyelid. "Please don't weep for little Dorian," he said quietly. "Today you rode out hawking in his company, and you dined this very evening at his board." She recoiled so violently that the tear fell from her eyelid and slid down her cheek. She stared at him. "I do not understand. Dorian is the Caliph."
If this be true, which it cannot be, we are cousins. Bravo, cuz! You have arrived at where we started our conversation. She shook her head. It cannot be. Yet there is something about you. She broke off, then began again. At our very first meeting, I felt something, an affinity, a bond that I could not explain to myself. She looked distraught. If all this is a jest, then it is a cruel one. No jest. I swear it to you. I need more than that to convince me. There is more, a great deal more. You shall have as much of it as you can possibly desire. Shall I tell you first how Dorian was sold by the pirates to the Caliph Al-Malik, and how the Caliph came to love him so that he adopted him as his own son? Shall I tell you how Dorian fell in love with his adoptive half-sister, Princess Yasmini, and they eloped together? How she bore him a son, whom they named Mansur? How Yasmini's half-brother, Zayn al-Din, became Caliph after the death of Al-Malik? How, not a year past, Zayn al-Din sent an assassin to murder my mother, Yasmini? Mansur. Verity's face was as white as the marble Aphrodite's. Your mother? Zayn al-Din murdered her? This is the main reason we have returned to Oman, my father and I, to avenge my mother's death and to deliver our people from tyranny. But now I must tell you the truth about my Uncle Tom. He is not the monster you paint him. My father told us. I last saw Uncle Tom scarcely a year ago, hale and flourishing in Africa. He is a kind person, brave and true. He is married to your Aunt Sarah, your mother Caroline's younger sister. Sarah is dead, Verity exclaimed. She is very much alive. If you knew her, you would love her as I do. She is so much like you, strong and proud. She even looks a great deal like you. She is tall and very beautiful. He smiled and added softly, She has your nose. Verity touched her own and smiled faintly. With such a nose as mine, she cannot be so beautiful. The little smile faded. They told me. My mother and father told me they were all dead. Dorian, Tom, and Sarah. Verity covered her eyes with one hand as she tried to assimilate what he had told her. Tom Courtney made two mistakes in his life. He killed his brother William in a fair fight, defending himself when Black Billy tried to murder him. I heard that Tom stabbed William while he slept. She dropped her hand and stared at him. Tom's other mistake was to father your brother Christopher. That is the reason your mother and father hated him so. No! She leapt to her feet. My brother is no bastard. My mother is no whore. Your mother conceived in love. That is not harlotry, Mansur said, and she sank down again. She reached across the gap between them and laid her hand on his arm. Oh, Mansur, this is too much for me to endure. Your words tear my world apart. I do not tell you this to torment you, Verity, but for both our sakes. I do not understand. I have fallen in love with you, Mansur said. You asked who I am, and because I love you, I must tell you. You delude yourself and me, she whispered. Love is not something that falls like manna from the sky, full-formed and complete. It grows between two persons. Tell me you feel nothing, Verity. She would not reply. Instead, she sprang to her feet and looked to the night sky as if seeking escape. The dawn is breaking. My father must not learn I have been with you. I must go back to my tent at once. "Answer my question before you go," he insisted. "Tell me you feel nothing, and I will trouble you no further. How can I tell you that when I know not what I feel? I owe you my life, but beyond that I cannot yet tell. Verity, give me one small grain of hope. No, Mansur, I must go. Not another word. Will you come to meet me here again tomorrow evening? You do not know my father," she stopped herself. "I can promise nothing. There is so much more that I must tell you." She laughed shortly, then stopped herself. "Have you not told me sufficient to last me a lifetime? Will you come? I will try, but only to hear the rest of your story." She snatched up the lamp and pulled the hood of her cloak over her head, covering her face, and ran from the temple.